Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why are we always on the lookout for the next big thing? We follow the latest news, frequently update our wardrobes, computers, and communication technologies, and eagerly await fresh episodes of our favorite TV shows. So what are the trade-offs of having brains wired to seek out and react to whatever we find surprising? And what other human qualities can keep relentless novelty-seeking from leading us to impulsive and risky behaviors? Author Winifred Gallagher explores these questions in her latest book, New, Understanding Our Need for Novelty and Change. Winifred, welcome to Think.
I'm delighted to be with you.
You write that our brains have developed as surprise detectors. What is the advantage of that?
Well, on the very simplest level, we react to new things because they are the likeliest to impact our survival. Something different in your environment is much more likely to be a threat to you or a reward for you than the same old thing. And even newborn babies will stare at a new image for about 41 seconds and then tune out if you keep showing them that image. So this instinct to pay attention to new things is very, very deep in us. As we get older, you'll probably notice at airports that even if you don't want to look at the TV in an airport or a restaurant or a bar, every once in a while you can't help it because those changing images, those constant flickering of new things coming on the screen, you're just hardwired to pay attention to them.
And there are essentially three types of people in terms of our responses to what is new, arranged along a continuum. We can be neophobes, neophiles, or neophiliacs. Define those terms for us.
Yeah, I think the most basic term we need to understand is neophilia, and that simply means our unique human affinity for things that are new or different. Of all nature species, we are the novelty specialist. We are primed both biologically and psychologically to adapt to, learn about, and create the new things that will help us survive and prosper. And we developed this wonderful gift during our long evolution in Africa during an extended period of very, very volatile environmental upheaval. This happened between 800,000 years ago and 195,000 years ago when we first emerged as a species. During that long time, torrential monsoon-type rains alternated with devastating droughts so that what had been a tropical forest would turn into a desert. And unlike many species, including other hominids with big brains very much like us, we learn to adapt to the changing conditions of that very unpredictable world. In fact, people, this is one of the surprises of my research. I didn't realize that, in fact, our neophilia saved us from extinction about 80,000 years ago. We came very close to becoming extinct ourselves during a period of particularly catastrophic climate change, probably extreme aridity. Anthropologists estimate that reproductive Homo sapiens couples were numbered only a few thousand and perhaps as few as 600 couples. And all of us on the planet today, of course, are descended from that group. And today's tsunamis and earthquakes and floods and hurricanes remind us that we still live on a very, very changeable planet. So that said, we are all, as a species, Homo sapiens is a neophile species. We are able to adapt to change and novelty and even to pursue it and to create it, which is really makes us unique. However, as individuals, we differ tremendously in how we express that neophilia. It's a continuum or a bell-shaped curve in which about 15% of us are the very adventurous people I call neophiliacs. They can live too fast and die too young, but they also explore and experiment and push the envelope for the rest of us, often in very productive ways. I think of the late Steve Jobs in one area of life, or a couple weeks ago, we celebrated the 90th birthday of an outstanding American neophiliac, the astronaut Senator John Glenn, who had been you know, a test pilot for the military, then an astronaut, then a senator, and at the age of 90, had just recently stopped flying his own plane, not because he wasn't acute enough mentally, but because he had had knee surgeries that made it difficult to get in and out of the plane. So someone like that has actually lived several lives in one. On the other end of the spectrum, there are about 15% of us who are the folks that I call neophobes, who instinctively want to avoid the risk associated with new things and prefer routine and the familiar. And their very thoughtful, reflective nature is very well suited for careers in science, academia, the arts. These are not the folks who are going to be test pilots or astronauts, but they are going to be philosophers and artists. And if there had been more of these careful, risk-averse types on Wall Street, we might have avoided a major recession. So, you know, there are benefits to that type. And, of course, most of us, about 70% of us, are moderate neophiles in between those two extremes of different degrees, some of us tending more in one direction than the other. And we don't want to be scared stiff by too much novelty, the way John Glenn might delight in adventure. But we don't want to be bored stiff by too little novelty either. Our advantage is because we're not biologically primed to react to in knee-jerk style in an extreme way to new things. We can respond to something new more flexibly. We can take our time to consider the various options. Do we want to engage with this new thing, or do we want to back off and think about it, or do we want to avoid it?
When you talk about flexibility, Winifred, I thought this was a fascinating account. We are not necessarily locked into the temperament that our biology seems to have given us. And a great example of that is someone like Eleanor Roosevelt.
Yes. And this is a very important point. People tend to think, in relatively recent human history, there's evidence of genetic influences on behavior. And initially, there was a lot of talk about genes determine behavior. They predict that you're going to turn out this way or that way. One of the big advances in behavioral science more recently is that genes and environment together create kind of a second nature. And Eleanor Roosevelt is a great example of that. She was such a shy, retiring, awkward little girl that her own mother called her granny. She was just painfully shy. Her mother died when she was quite young, followed by her father, whom she adored. And she was, you know, the classic poor little rich girl. She was essentially raised by her grandmother, who, when Eleanor got a little older, sent her to England and changed her life by enrolling her in a very progressive school for girls that was run by an early feminist educator who believed that girls had to be encouraged to stand on their own feet and develop their own talents and opinions on things. And Eleanor just blossomed in this environment. And when she came back to New York, instead of taking up her role as a wealthy little debutante, she began to work for social justice in the slums of New York. She took her very dashing cousin, Franklin, who was then a Harvard student, on a tour of the tenements that changed his ideas about the world and about social justice as well. And just throughout her life was able to transform herself through often situations that look like, you know, terrible adversity, like her husband's paralysis. Eleanor had to become... overcome her own shy nature and go out and be Franklin's legs and Franklin's voice. She went out and gave speeches for him, met strangers, all stuff that would have been, you know, really anathema to her early in her life. And she just continued to develop so that when she finally reached her real potential, President Harry Truman called her the First Lady of the World.
On the other hand, you know, you mentioned that the John Glenns and the Steve Jobs of the world, and clearly they are men who are and were comfortable with taking risks and trying new things. However, to really succeed with a sort of neophiliac personality, one also needs a great deal of self-discipline so that you stay focused.
That's exactly right. psychologists who study personality like to say that the only difference between the cop and the robber is their upbringing.
Yeah.
And if you had taken a John Glenn, who was obviously raised to value law and order, respect the rights of others, apply his prodigious energies in productive ways, if you had taken that same type of kid and put that kid in a slum situation, raised by a single parent with drug problems, let's say, no one paying attention to how he was doing in school, no one teaching him to respect the rights of others and obey the law, you have that same thrill-seeking, novelty-seeking temperament that can very easily get involved in a life of crime.
Neophilia is more common in men than in women?
No, I wouldn't say that. In fact, we kind of want to think that, I think, because of the long tradition of thinking of adventurous people as being like the mountain men and the cowboys and the astronauts. But personality research, epidemiological research, shows that there are not actually that many differences between male and female personality. The strongest one is actually the fact that women are more pro-social than men. Women are a little bit more cooperative and more empathetic in terms of dealing with other people than men. That's the one that pops up the most. That said, there is some research showing that among male and female neophiliacs, and there are plenty of female neophiliacs, I mean, think of your favorite party animal person, men may express this more frequently in terms of physical risk-taking activities like big game hunting or extreme sports or big wave surfing.
It does seem that we change a bit over time. I was talking to my kids the other day about things I used to do on roller skates that I would not consider even trying today now that I am in my 40s.
Yeah, that is certainly the case. I live in Wyoming now, and I grew up with horses back on the East Coast. And, of course, here I'm back in a horse culture much later in life, and I'm thinking, I can't believe the stuff I used to do on my horse when I was a kid. That's definitely the case. And there is very good research that shows that novelty-seeking, and this won't surprise you if you have children or if anybody just remembers their own adolescence, novelty-seeking peaks in adolescence in the late teens. For a very good reason. It's very important for kids who need to leave the nest and go out and engage with the world to feel inspired and drawn to new things. And that's, in fact, the way it goes, not just for us, but for many other animal species as well. Interestingly, though, by the time you reach about the age 60, novelty seeking has been reduced by about half. And my favorite example of this is Keith Richards, the Rolling Stone. I read his biography that came out a year or so ago, and even Keith Richards, who you would have to say is the raging neophiliac of all time, many dimensions, even Keith Richards now in his 60s talks about how much he enjoys quiet nights with Patty and the kids at home. So if it's true of Keith, I think it's probably true of the rest of us.
He's watching his cholesterol and just taking good care of himself.
Well, yeah, he's certainly not the wild and crazy Rolling Stone that he used to be, although I'm sure he's plenty feisty even still.
My guest is author Winifred Gallagher. Her new book is called New, Understanding Our Need for Novelty and Change. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. We have phone lines open now. The number is 1-800-933-5372. If you'd like to join us, you can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Winifred Gallagher. Her book is called New, Understanding Our Need for Novelty and Change. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Winifred, I have to say I'm fascinated by what you call in the book the migration gene and how it might have affected the development of particular societies over time, particularly with regard to those that are sort of immigrant dominant populations like our own and other places that are more that are less culturally diverse.
Yeah, that was a fascinating part of my research. I thought certain genes affect our different balances of a major neurochemical called dopamine. And much like neophilia itself, dopamine is all about the anticipation and pursuit of novelty and rewards. Dopamine makes you want new things, want rewarding things. And variants of a dopamine gene called the DRD4 gene, and these variants are called the 7R, 5R, and 2R alleles, which just simply means genetic variant. These variants contribute to a nervous system that seems to become more strongly aroused by novelty and rewards than other nervous systems, and also adapts to them very quickly, gets used to them very quickly, and is very rapidly ready for more. So this is the person who, whether it's at a party or playing sports or whatever, as soon as they engage, as soon as something novel and interesting comes along, they want to engage with it. The thrill of that engagement wears off pretty fast, and then they're looking for the next big buzz. Hmm. So this does seem to be a genetically influenced disposition. I think probably because I'm here in the West, a good example of this would be Kit Carson, the famous mountain man and tracker and guide, who was known even among a lot of, he traveled, I'm sure, in a very fearless neophiliac kind of culture, but even amidst that group, he was known for his ability to respond to something very, very novel, whether it was an attack by a grizzly bear or an attack by hostile Indians, react to it very quickly, get over the shock of it. So while other people were still standing there kind of slack-jawed trying to figure out what to do, he was already engaged in his reaction time. So this is that kind of quality. Very excited by new things, get over the thrill very quickly, looking for the next big thrill.
And so if we have a country of maybe modified Kit Carsons who have left at some point in our history, left their homelands to come here, does that create the conditions we have in this society where we sometimes, to our detriment, can't get enough of the next big thing and don't necessarily value what came before?
Well, like individuals, societies vary in their approaches to the new and different. Mm-hmm. And as you were indicating, sometimes for biological reasons. It has long been known that people with certain temperaments are attracted to certain kinds of environments and not to others. This is called the person-environment fit. So I once did an interview with a psychiatrist up in Fairbanks, Alaska, who said that he had done his training at the Menninger Foundation in Kansas, and many of their patients in that very earnest, hardworking, slightly inclining to depression culture, most of their patients were suffering from depression. And when they got a bipolar patient, someone who suffered from manic depression, the teachers would get all the students and residents together and say, you have to come look at this guy because we don't see many of them here in Kansas.
Hmm.
On the other hand, this psychiatrist himself migrated to Fairbanks, Alaska, which is a very, you know, extreme environment. And he said in his little four-bed psychiatric facility, all four beds were usually taken up by people with bipolar disorder.
Wow.
So different environments, I mean, that's using an illness as an example, but the same thing is true of tendencies that aren't illnesses. So in our nation of immigrants, I mean, everybody who was not a Native American, everybody in this country who was not a Native American is descended from somebody who had to get on a boat or a plane and get themselves here, which, you know, in itself is a kind of self-sorting, novelty-seeking effort. And not very surprisingly, a hefty 25% of us carry the one of the novelty-seeking genetic variants that I mentioned before, one of the DRD4 alleles. These same alleles are particularly DRD47R, which is the most extreme novelty-seeking variant, are extremely rare in other nations, notably traditionally very risk-averse conservative China.
Hmm.
The gene 7R did exist in China one time, but it is exceptionally rare there now. And one theory is that temperament environment sorting process, just as China became more and more focused on a Mandarin bureaucracy and the cultivation of rice, the sort of footloose, thrill-seeking personality didn't really prosper in that type of culture anymore and moved on or perhaps even died out.
I just love thinking about that because, of course, we don't want to, you know, paint a billion people with the same broad brush. But we think about the reasons why the education system there is different. And maybe that's why there is less innovation coming out of places like China. But it could very well boil down to our DNA.
It's certainly a factor. And as you say, it's not a comfortable thing to talk about sometimes for very good reasons in our world that's increasingly global. On the other hand, there are differences in the way, there are differences out there, and biology does play a role in those differences. And it doesn't have to be a bad thing. I mean, the reason why one person might say, I want to go to Sweden on my vacation, and another person says, you know, it's Italy for me. I just love that wine, woman, and song thing. It's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. It makes us a varied population. But those differences do exist, and China, in fact, is extremely conscious of the fact that it has a relatively poor reputation for innovation, that it's known as sort of a copycat, you know, the people who manufacture iPods rather than invent them, and in fact has 2 years ago started an ambitious program to increase the number of creative patents that Chinese citizens are issued by giving the people who win those patents better housing and other rewards. So, you know, this is just the way it is, and I think we can also, as Americans, we've been beating ourselves up a lot about you know, all the with the economic downturn and very unfavorable comparisons to China, that they're so disciplined and they're surging ahead and we're falling behind. But I think we need to look at our own terrific strength. America is the most innovative culture in history. And I think we need to remember that and feel good about that and put our money in our resources, developing our innovative skills the same way China puts its resources, maximizing what they can do very well with these huge these new cities that are, you know, massive industrial manufacturing facilities. So, you know, we have something to bring to the party, too.
Winifred Gallagher is here. We're talking about her latest book. It's called New. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. And as we go to the phones now, we'll speak with David in California. Hi, David.
Hey, greetings. You know, I wanted to ask about the stability of an economy when you start having boom and bust inventions. In other words, if you've got a society that has too many inventors, too many go-getters, too many type A personalities, you end up with a lot of infighting and economic battles, all sorts of strange interactions, headbutting, let's say. And out here in California, of course, we had our dot-com economy a few years ago, and it was great in a way, but at the same time, when somebody put a huge amount of investment into an invention, and then 6 weeks later, it was completely outmoded. You had insane boom and bust problems, and for the average person that's invested in shoelaces or eyeglass frames or toenail clippers or something like that, the stability of society, nobody can keep up with investments that are, you know, if somebody's getting 190% rate on return, nobody wants to invest in a 2% rate of return anymore. And so stable parts of society are crushed by the exuberance, let's say, of an inventive society.
Mm-hmm. I would say that the issue here is with so many behavioral tendencies, the issue is achieving some form of balance. You don't want a culture that's too stable and too static, because then there's no growth and there's no energy. On the other hand, like all forms of human behavior, neophilia has pluses and minuses. Our affinity for new things spurs us to learn and do things that have never been done before, from exploring space to inventing new technology to creating art. It's a truly wonderful quality. One of my favorite examples is some research that came out of MIT that was actually conducted in Britain, where the researcher found that over a three-year period, individuals connected by the Internet put more money into inventing new products and tweaking existing ones than did corporations.
Hmm.
So if you were a mountain biker or a fly fisherman, you could go on the Internet and find and say, I'm not really satisfied with the existing widget that I think could be made better. What do you think? And this kind of interaction, even without any corporate involvement, resulted in a lot of new innovative products. Now, of course, on the, if the good thing about our neophilia is that it spurs us to learn and do new things, the downside is that, especially at its extreme, and this is speaking to the caller's concerns, novelty-seeking can be very risky. It can jeopardize safety, it can jeopardize your finances, it can jeopardize your marital fidelity and your sobriety and all kinds of good behavior. And I think increasingly in our culture, it can fuel a kind of chronic restlessness and dissatisfaction where we're just looking for the next new thing. This is particularly clear, I think, in the area of information. We are now consuming about 350% more words from various media than we did just 30 years ago.
Hmm.
That's a massive change, however you want to look at it. Since 1980, we are now consuming 350% more words. So this level of overstimulation can lower your boredom threshold and create a kind of a vicious circle in which you're constantly seeking the excitement of the latest tweet or text or news bite. Then you quickly get over it, and you're immediately searching for the next one. So that's kind of the downside.
Yeah, and if we're not careful, we can go a mile wide and an inch deep, but we have the power to channel that that neophilia into a really deep search into something we find interesting.
Yes, I mean, you actually used the exact language that I like to use here. The challenge is to focus your novelty seeking on going deep into new things that matter to you, whether it's politics or French cooking or Buddhism or whatever it is. Go deep into that. Find out all the new things that are emerging in that field, rather than letting your neophilia kind of spray your attention in a wide, shallow way. So the idea is go deep, not shallow and wide. And of course, we've all had that experience of going online and you know, you're just kind of clicking around, and you buy a pair of slippers from an online catalog that you don't really need because they're only $9.99, and then you click from that to the latest Kim Kardashian celebrity gossip, and then to the, you know, some marriage problems of some presidential candidate. And before you look up, and you know, an hour and a half has gone by, and you have nothing to show for it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's using neophilia, just pursuing novelty for its own sake without getting anything out of it, and that's what we want to avoid.
Let's jump back on the phones now. This time we have Jim on the line in Fort Worth. Hello, Jim.
Chris, how are you today?
Great, thank you.
Winifred, I'm interested in a couple questions. Number one, to what extent can neophilia behaviors be profiled either genetically or behaviorally? at a early age? And secondly, how do those tendencies express themselves in more seemingly more mundane areas such as career choices? I'm thinking about, for example, you know, career hopping or job hopping behavior, as well as sexual and emotional partnership choices. And then on that last point, what implications that might have for you know, the gene pool over the long haul?
Thanks for your call, Jim.
Thank you.
Okay. First of all, I think some of those questions could be answered if your listeners would like to go on the New York Times website and type in Winifred Gallagher. They will come up with a story that the Times did on neophilia with a link to a test that the Times posted. So you can take a little test and see where you rank in terms of whether you're a neophiliac or a neophobe or a neophile.
I took the test, by the way, and it's lots of fun.
Yeah. Anyway, to go on to the first point, I believe, which was how these tendencies manifest themselves in babies and young children, and in fact some wonderful research done by Jerome Kagan at Harvard over many years shows that right from the beginning of life, and he does babies and toddlers, some children have what he calls a shy temperament. This is the sensitive, neophobic temperament, where the mom brings baby into the lab and steps out of the room, and the baby sees a stranger, or maybe they pop a balloon, or do something, you know, a mild stressor that, of course, is not particularly stressful on the way we think about stress, but
yeah,
to a newborn, or not a newborn, but a couple months old child or a toddler. And right away, some of these children react, burst into tears, panic, mommy, 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 where's mommy? He has other children who he calls bold, who see the stranger, hear the balloon pop, and go, wow, what was that? Give me more.
Let me jump in here so you can answer the rest after the break. My guest is author Winifred Gallagher. Her new book is called New, Understanding Our Need for Novelty and Change. If you'd like to join the conversation, send email to think@kera.org or call in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Author Winifred Gallagher is my guest this hour. Her latest book is called New, Understanding Our Need for Novelty and Change. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. Before the break, Winifred, you were telling us about research that finds that some babies are terrified by little bits of novelty and stress, while others are delighted and sort of can't get enough.
Yeah, and what's important about that research, it's not only important for parents trying to recognize the temperaments of their children and respond accordingly. It shows that really the tendency to either approach or avoid the new is the most important stable behavioral difference among individuals in the same species, period.
Hmm.
I mean, this is true of kittens and puppies. And monkeys the same as it is of us. Nothing reveals your personality, no single thing reveals your basic personality more clearly and immediately than your emotional reaction to new things over a long period of time and across many situations. So it's a very important thing to know about yourself and to understand that there's no good or bad. One isn't better or worse than the other, but they're different. They have different drawbacks and advantages, and to know your drawbacks and advantages, and know how you respond to new things, and how you might be able to tweak that a little bit to become more productive. If you're inclining in the neophiliac direction, you might occasionally feel like your life is a bit scattered and unfocused, and you might need to practice using your extreme neophilia more like a laser than a floodlight.
Mm-hmm.
Focus on new things that relate to things that have enduring value and that really matter to you, and dismiss the rest as distractions. On the other hand, if you're inclining toward the neophobic direction and your life feels a little flat and boring, you can liven things up by deliberately cultivating your curiosity about new things. Curiosity, we sometimes forget, is actually an emotion, and you can cultivate it. Some of us have a lot of it naturally, but those of us who don't can say, life is a little boring. I'm not a naturally curious person, but I want to liven things up, and I'm going to pick up that community college catalog, and I'm going to sign up for a course in something that I know nothing about. So that, you know, those are the ways you can sort of tweak your natural degree of neophilia.
And as to the other part of Jim's question about whether or not this, I believe he was asking about whether it determines the kinds of careers we're drawn to.
Yeah, I mean, he mentioned career skipping. If you're constantly changing jobs, if you're constantly changing romantic partners, these are indications of a kind of neophiliac tendency. Most of us, though, interestingly, have a very sensible way of dealing with this. We don't want too much novelty, especially in serious long-term endeavors that really matter to us, like career and close relationships, family. On the other hand, we tend to be much more adventurous and much more interested in novelty-seeking in our intellectual, creative, and recreational pursuits. So that's how most of us kind of find a balance where we keep the lid on more in terms of work and family, and we're a little more explorative and adventurous in on our off time, our weekend pursuits, and our hobbies and our avocations.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Next up, we have Kim in Dallas. Hey, Kim.
Hi. I lost my voice. I'm sorry. So I hope you all can understand.
We can. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm just curious if there's any possible connection between the frontal lobe development associated with risk-taking, because earlier you mentioned about teenagers and being crazy risk-takers, and then that kind of subsides, and immediately I thought of, well, you know, the frontal lobe has developed, and I'm wondering if maybe with risk-takers like John Glenn, if maybe there's some kind of physical brain difference that mm-hmm. maybe he doesn't, you know, think through the consequences like the rest of the population.
What do you think, Winifred?
Mm-hmm. Well, we certainly know that John Glenn is very good at thinking through the consequences of things. Otherwise, he would have crashed his planes. So here again, some of that has to do with, the way you were socialized and the way you were educated and how you're able to harness that novelty-seeking quality. On the other hand, brain scans show that when neophiliacs and neophobes have a very different brain reaction when they come upon something new. The neophiliacs have an immediate, strong response that springs from a brain part called the insula, which helps govern emotional arousal. And their interior cingulate cortex, which is another brain part, this is a brain part that tends to dampen risky behavior, only activates after they're already primed to proceed. So the kind of thrill-seeking, oh, wow, let's go for it, insula, kicks in right away, and the anterior cingulate cortex, which is the thing that makes you sort of hold back and say, I don't know about this, that only kicks in weakly after they're already psyched to proceed. And in neophobes, they have the exact opposite of the sequence, so that they first experience a strong, uh-oh, watch out, avoid this reaction, and only later do they get a reaction from the insula that says maybe you should go for it. So there very likely are biological and genetic influences. We talked about the genetic influences in governing dopamine earlier, there are biological as well as environmental reasons why we are the way we are.
Certainly, Winifred, affluence, relative affluence has a lot to do with this, but I wonder if our love of the new in this country, in this society, also has to do with our consumer culture and the fact that it is reasonable sometimes to criticize our using up of things and throwing them aside to get the next new thing.
Yeah, that's certainly one of the minuses. If our novelty seeking, and here I'm thinking of shopaholics, mm-hmm. Apple. If novelty seeking is just taking you down the road where all you're doing is going from one buzz to the other, and you don't have anything really substantial to show for it, that's a sign of trouble. That's something that should be examined the same way if you're spending a lot of time on the computer and you don't really have anything to show for it. It's worth looking at that. The definitive research has yet to be done, but many very serious scientists believe that aided by the kinds of technology we have, certain individuals can indeed become addicted to new information. And the comparison they draw is with gambling, which has been very well studied. We tend to think that when we think of addiction, we think of alcohol or drugs, but it's very possible to become addicted to experiences as well. And if you're a person who, when you can't access your smartphone or your computer or whatever, you start to show the telltale symptoms of addiction, such as anxiety, discomfort, distraction, those are signs that your behavior is becoming compulsive or even addicted, and it bears thinking about. I think the best and most the scariest example of this is texting in the car.
Mm-hmm.
Texting in the car has been proven over and over again to just be an absolutely deadly, deadly, deadly thing to do. And yet, as many as half of young people under 30 are thought to indulge in texting in the car. And if you read accounts of people who get in accidents while texting, they'll say, "I just couldn't help myself." So, I mean, there again, that's another symptom of addictive behavior. If you're doing something that is either dangerous to you or other people, and you know that and you can't stop, that should be a red light. I would say video gaming has similar compulsive or even addictive potential. If you find that you're gaming so much that you're not going to school, you're not doing your homework, you're slacking off at the job, you're not interacting with real people, you're on these games all the time, those are red lights that bear thinking about.
Do neophobes, neophiles, and neophiliacs have trouble understanding one another and communicating effectively?
That's a good question. I think that many, many spouses, many arguments between spouses about how fast is speeding or mm-hmm. who is tailgating or where we should go for vacation or was that flirting with that lady at the party or was that just being friendly, these kinds of discussions, I think, very often have roots in different ideas about novelty. And there, again, it's a good reason to understand where you and your significant others are on the scale so that you can better understand the other person.
Do you find that most people, with or without the quiz, are able to identify pretty accurately which type they are?
Yes and no. I mean, I think some... I previously wrote a book some years ago about personality and temperament, and the researchers that I spoke to pretty much thought that not very many people have a lot of insight into their own behavior, that some people have some and a lot of people have very little. So I think it is some of us do understand ourselves pretty well and some of us don't, but all of us can do a better job at it.
Let's go back to the phones for one final question from Paul in Dallas. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Very well, thank you.
Good. I've been listening to shows. Great show. I'm definitely would be the neophile. My wife would be the opposite of that, and we have a son who acts just like me. And so, taking that into account, my wife, began to observe these things in my son and said that I was the same way. I've looked a little bit into the lives of like Da Vinci and Edison, Teddy Roosevelt, Einstein, and a man by the name of Bert Rutan, who all seem to appear to be very creative, and yet they had jumped from project to project. And in my mind, that seems to relate to attention deficit disorder and hyperactivity. Mm-hmm. How does neophilia relate to hyperactivity disorder? Hyperactivity and attention deficit.
Yeah, my question to you was immediately whether your son was having attention issues in school, if he's old enough to go to school. There is a connection between neophiliac behavior and ADHD. Like people who have ADHD, carriers of the DRD4/7R variant tend to be excitable and easily bored. And interestingly, those symptoms are eased by both Ritalin and novelty-seeking behavior.
Hmm.
So that if you're a jumpy 7R carrier, as one of my, I have five kids, and my little guy, my youngest son, had big attention issues in school. But interestingly, he only had them in Spanish and math. He didn't have them in English or history or the other classes he enjoyed, and he certainly didn't have them on the hockey rink or when fly fishing. So as long as this person is able to express the novelty-seeking behavior in a healthy way by engaging with new things that are productive, that's fine. It doesn't cause a problem. But we do have to sit through math and Spanish class whether we like it or not. So that's where the Ritalin comes in, which will produce somewhat of the same thing. 7R, interestingly, that allele seems to apply the brakes to brain cells that inhibit both movement and attention. That's interesting because carriers have more trouble staying focused in a dull setting, but they also have much faster reaction times.
Hmm.
And that combination draws them to some very exciting activities and can be very adaptive in certain environments. Here again, I'm thinking of Kit Carson, who was illiterate. He never learned to read or write, although he was very bright. He spoke fluent Spanish, several Indian languages, and was notorious, as one observer said, Kit waits for nobody. So there again, you have that trouble staying focused in a dull setting like a classroom, but very fast reaction times.
I'm guessing I know the answer to this, but where do you fall on the spectrum?
I am kind of a high-end neophile. Mm-hmm. I am in the higher reach of that behavior, reaching up into neophiliac behavior, where my husband is.
And you're still together. Well, that's a good sign.
Yeah, and I think we're close enough. I think if he's a real thrill seeker, you know, the mountain can't be high enough for skiing, and it's just a very intense engagement with all kinds of thrill-seeking activities. And I think if I were really neophobic, we would have a lot of trouble. But we are able to meet in the middle. So I'll go cross-country skiing with him, but not downhill.
Winifred Gallagher's latest book is called New, Understanding Our Need for Novelty and Change. Winifred, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was delightful.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about the show and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.